Good morning, everyone, and welcome to CSIS, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, briefing on the President's upcoming trip to the NATO summit. I'm really glad that you all could be here today. I know it was a big stretch to miss the President giving the Bassmaster Award to the serious stuff. I remember that from when I was over there myself. But I'm really glad to see all of you here today, and we've got a terrific panel, and I'll get right to it. I'm going to lead off with Julianne Smith, who is our Europe Program Director. Following Julianne, we'll hear from Dr. Steve Flanagan, who is our Senior Vice President and Henry Kissinger Chair in International Strategy. In addition, Steve is the Director of our International Security Program. And then we have Mr. Janusz Bugajski, who is the head of our new European Democracies Program. I know of no one in town or anywhere who knows more about this stuff than Janusz, and I'm sure you'll find him very informative. And with that, I will pass it over to Julianne.
Thanks, Andrew, and good morning. Thanks for coming over to CSIS this morning. We're all going to just make a few minutes worth of remarks and then really get to your questions and see what direction you want to take this. I thought I would just offer up the 60,000-foot view of what the atmospherics are like heading into the summit, and then I'll allow Janusz and Steve to get into some of the details, some of the initiatives that you're likely to see, some of the more hot-button issues that will be discussed in Bucharest. So I think leading up to this summit, the question for me is, is this really some sort of defining moment for the alliance, as we're hearing NATO headquarters kind of couching it in those terms, or is this a moment of deja vu? And for me, there is an element or an air of deja vu to this summit for three different reasons. First and foremost, Afghanistan is going to eclipse the summit agenda, much like it did in 2006 in the Riga summit. You've all heard about the challenges that we're facing on the ground in Afghanistan. Steve will get into some of those. It's a very long list, both on the military side, where NATO needs more troops on the ground, but also on the reconstruction side. There are coordination issues with all of the bodies that are operating on the ground, both civilian and military. There are issues with Karzai and his team, of course, the border region with Pakistan. But the one I really wanted to highlight for you is the fact that we have a bit of a blame game going on between Europe and the United States at this moment. Europeans, as you've heard, have been accused of really losing faith in the mission on the ground in Afghanistan. You've heard some of the leaders in Europe talk about their skepticism that we can actually win this mission on the ground, that NATO has the capabilities it needs to see this mission through. And I'm sure you're aware of the fact that there's increasing public opposition to this ground, to this mission on the ground, and a lot of European publics have been calling for some sort of exit strategy. Americans, on the other side of the equation, have been accused of losing focus. Not faith, but focus. Why? Because Europeans claim that the United States, for the last couple of years, has been heavily focused on what's going on in Iraq, that for us, that has been mission number one, and that we, in fact, have not put the required political capital, the resources, into the mission in Afghanistan. So you've got a little bit of finger-pointing going on. You're going to see some efforts to try and get around some of that finger-pointing in Bucharest, but this is very similar to what we saw in Riga in 2006. Secondly, I feel this summit has an air of deja vu because at a more broader level, we have a very deep strategic divide inside the alliance on what the alliance's future roles and missions should look like. On one side of the equation, you have countries like the United States convinced that NATO should have more global missions, more global partnerships. It should address new threats, new challenges. And then you've got the other side of the alliance that takes a much more conservative view. France, for example, would subscribe to this, that the alliance should kind of step back, focus on its traditional mission of collective defense and security in the Euro-Atlantic area, and not get ahead of itself and be too ambitious with its vision and in crafting kind of where it's going to go in the next 10 to 20 years. This is a debate we've seen inside the alliance for the last couple of years, but it's really coming to a head over Afghanistan because part of the alliance feels that Afghanistan should be a precedent for future missions, and part of the alliance feels like it should be an exception, perhaps never to be repeated again. The last thing I would mention is capabilities, capabilities, capabilities. This is an issue that has haunted the alliance for many, many years. Almost at every summit that I can remember, the alliance has struggled to address the capability shortfalls that exist. things like air-to-air refueling, strategic lift, C4ISR. We still have a number of members inside the alliance that have failed to transform their militaries to cope with expeditionary operations. So that's why I would say this summit definitely has an air of deja vu to it. I won't argue that there'll be no new initiatives, no breaking news. That's not the case. You'll hear from my colleagues some really interesting things coming out of the summit. The one last thing I would mention in terms of an interesting development on Afghanistan is there will be a vision statement that will be presented at the summit. This is trying to counter the European complaint that NATO lacks some sort of roadmap on the ground, that it never has determined what its goals are, how we will know if we've won the mission, that there are no goalposts, there are no metrics. And so NATO's going to try to do that. The Pentagon has been very busy in the last couple of months conducting a strategic review that will get at the heart of those questions, and hopefully European governments can take that vision statement, that roadmap, back to their publics and explain why Afghanistan matters for the people of Afghanistan, why it matters for the safety and security of Europeans and Americans and Canadians, and why it matters for the transatlantic relationship more broadly. So I'll leave it at that, and I'll turn it over to Steve and Yanis to talk about some of the specifics, some of the bits of breaking news that you will see coming out of Bucharest.
Great, thank you. I was going to touch on the main defense and military action that at the summit, particularly Afghanistan, but also missile defense, some a little bit more detail on the capabilities issue, Kosovo, and also the new initiative on clarifying NATO's role in cyber defense, which is kind of an issue that's been moving along a little bit below the radar, but we'll get some additional push at Bucharest. On Afghanistan, as Julie said, that's going to be clearly the dominant issue overarching everything at the summit. The U.S. and other governments have been urging additional troop and equipment commitments from a number of other allies to join the small coalition, the Canadians, the U.S., the Brits, and the Danes, who are in the south and the east in most heavily engaged in the counterinsurgency mission. That has proven to be a disappointing sort of outcome. The U.S. made some additional commitments of particularly sending the 3,200 additional Marines, and 2,200 of those will go to the south as a way to hopefully galvanize allied response, and actually also adding about 1,000 troops that will go to the very critical and neglected mission of training the Afghan police. Unfortunately, that hasn't proven to trigger too much of a response. The one bit of good news that it does appear that that the French will announce the commitment of about 1,000 elite paratroopers to operations probably in the east, although it could also be in the south as well to somewhat answer this challenge, particularly coming from the Canadians and others who have been in Kandahar and feeling a bit beleaguered and needing some additional support as they've had some doubts in their own domestic debate about the way in which risk and burden sharing is being shared within the alliance. So that would be the hope. We'll have a little bit more clarity on what's going to come from the French. There is a meeting that starts tomorrow. Gordon Brown and Sarkozy will discuss some of this. The French do want to link, though, this reaffirmation of their commitment to NATO missions in a highly visible way to further commitments from the British and also the United States on development of a full development of an independent European Union defense structure. And whether or not this will come to fruition in some kind of general endorsement at the Bucharest summit is still not clear. But as a long-term goal, certainly by the 2009 summit, the French would like to see this notion that they're moving ahead to reaffirm their commitment to NATO and perhaps even movement into the integrated back into the integrated military structure, but they want the quid for that is some kind of affirmation by the rest of the members of the alliance, so the and particularly the U.S. and the Brits, of a full development of a European defense capability. And we can come back to that because that gets into high theology, and I want to focus on more of the capabilities in the military area. As Julie mentioned, the other part of the Afghan agenda will be to try to highlight this notion and to undercut the trend in particularly European elite thinking that somehow this mission is not winnable, that NATO doesn't have a coherent strategy. Secretary Gates, of course, has been very forthright about some of his concerns about whether or not the NATO allies have a common approach to counterinsurgency, whether there needs to be further refinement and clarification of that operational concept, and different kinds of training to look at lessons the United States has learned, and some of the other allies have learned in operations in the East and the South, as well as lessons learned in Iraq. And so there may be some boost to that in the context of the summit communique endorsing this idea that NATO does have to further refine its strategy, perhaps rolled up with and integrated into this vision statement that, yes, we know that there has been important progress. We need this more integrated, what NATO calls its comprehensive approach of civilian and military efforts being brought together more effectively. And in particular, the big challenge has been NATO has been doing very well at the clear part of getting rid of terrorists and foreign fighters and Taliban out of certain areas. But then the problem becomes the hold and build part of it, and filling that that capacity and enhancing the alliance's capability to work also with the Afghan government to then reinsert its sovereignty and control over the areas that are liberated from the insurgents. So that will be I think a big part of the Afghan discussion. On Kosovo, it's not really an issue for that needs any further clarification. The mission is clear. More than 80% of the troops in Kosovo are European, but just in the time of stress, the allies will want to reaffirm their commitment to that mission, that it remains an important job, and steadfast resolve about, and Janusz will talk more about the politics of that decision, but on the military side, the allies will want to profile and remind everyone that NATO does have a sizable peacekeeping force in Kosovo, and affirm the importance of that mission. Missile defense is a complicated issue. It's a priority for the Bush administration, not so much a priority for some of the other allies. But that said, there are sort of two dimensions of this. NATO has had a program underway since 1999 in the development of theater missile defense for protection of forces against short and medium-range ballistic missiles. That is moving ahead on schedule. The first contract has been signed, and the development and the initial capabilities of that system based on Patriot and THAAD and some other existing capabilities will take place in 2010, full operational capability in about 2013. So the summit will probably endorse the notion that that is continuing, and to also welcome another part of this, which is more related to the U.S. bilateral discussions with the Czechs and the Poles, that is that NATO also launched in the Prague summit in 2002 a feasibility study of the development of a limited defense, missile defense of population centers. And that feasibility study has been ongoing. It's been sort of brought more to the fore in the context of the discussion that the U.S. has had on a bilateral basis with the Czechs and the Poles about the development of the radar in the Czech Republic and the 10 interceptor missiles to be deployed in Poland, also around ideally around 2013 or perhaps a bit later if the threat seems to be further on the horizon. So there will be probably some effort to endorse. Certainly, the Bush administration will be seeking in the summit communique an endorsement of NATO's continuing activities, both in theater missile defense and to note the important contribution that the U.S. and Polish and Czech cooperation in population defense could be an important contribution to deepening and strengthening the coverage of missile defense to all the alliance. And so, the Bush theme will be: we want to make sure that no part of the alliance is vulnerable to a specific kind of threat, particularly intermediate and longer range missiles, and so the importance of continuing the momentum on some kind of missile defense. A couple other smaller issues with regard to capabilities, in particular with regard to helicopters. As many of you know well, NATO has thousands of helicopters, but very few of them are capable of operating in the harsh environment and difficult operating conditions of Afghanistan. It remains a problem both because of limited operational budgets in a lot of these countries, but also certain political will and willingness to put some of these assets out there and at risk. But the hope is that there will be some kind of an initiative and endorsed by the summit, the heads of states and government, with regard to perhaps a pooling arrangement. In the past, there has been an initiative that was undertaken also at the Prague 2002 summit, which is coming, bearing some fruition of a pooling of aircraft for lift. That was one of the other things, and as Julie mentioned, the NATO expeditionary capabilities. The fact is that even those countries that have some assets that are deployable at a distance, they can't get themselves there. So there's been an effort to develop some C-17 aircraft that NATO would essentially own collectively and share the cost, in a sense, a timeshare use of those assets. That same model might be used or developed with regard to helicopters, or perhaps some other kind of initiative to help finance and deploy helicopters that could be maintained and operated in these kind of harsh conditions. There's also going to be some sort of welcoming and endorsement of a further coordination of NATO's special operating force activities. NATO has not really spent a lot of time until Afghanistan thinking about how its special operations forces would work together more effectively, but there's been a planning cell set up at SHAPE where coordination among, and going back to what Julie was saying, as part of this overall effort to integrate the strategy better in Afghanistan, the summit may welcome the progress in that area and talk about advancing further integration of special operations forces, training, tactics, and procedures, sort of down in the, a little bit down in the military weeds, but recognizing the importance and the value of that contribution in NATO that has not been prominent in the past. And in addition, kind of another tinkering on the capabilities area will be movement to the adjustment of the NATO Response Force, which was established in 2002, a 25,000 full capability force to go anywhere and on short notice. There's a recognition that the maintenance of the current operations in Afghanistan now has made it difficult to sustain that force as well as kind of an additional backup. So there'll be a looking at and an endorsement of a concept that was discussed by the NATO defense ministers earlier in Vilnius in February about a graduated response option in terms of generating that kind of a force, that is to say that not all elements of that 25,000-member force needs to be available. And then lastly, on the cyber, this is an initiative that particularly has come in the wake of the attacks against Estonia last year. There is a movement towards creating a NATO center of excellence in Tallinn in Estonia. The defense ministers agreed in Vilnius that NATO should have a substantial policy and capability in cyber defense, and they're sort of working out the modalities of how that will be operated and financed, and this will be given a boost by the NATO summit. So those are the main defense and military issues for the summit.
Okay, last but hopefully not least, I'm going to say a few words about two additional issues that will definitely feature on the summit agenda, even if they're not priority issues in the sense of the future of NATO operations. And both have, I think, significance for European security. First of all, enlargement in the Western Balkans. And secondly, the question of giving MAPs or membership action plans to Ukraine and Georgia. I'll mention Kosovo also in this context, although maybe I'll leave that to questions and answers. A lot to say about Kosovo, but it's not just a NATO issue. It's an east-west issue and sometimes also a west-west issue. So let me start with enlargement. Three countries, the U.S. Adriatic Charter countries, Albania, Croatia, and Macedonia, are all slated to receive invitations for membership at the summit. All three have generally fulfilled the criteria, the conditions for NATO entry, or at least to the extent that the previous invitees have, in terms of democratic reform, civil military reform, economic progress, good relations with neighbors, ethnic coexistence, and so forth. All three countries have also made contributions to NATO missions in Afghanistan and elsewhere, which you cannot say for all NATO countries. And as well as to U.S. operations in Iraq, which also cannot say for all NATO countries. NATO accession for the three, I believe, and they believe, will enhance security in the region, particularly at a time when there is a certain degree of uncertainty stemming from the recognition, the independence declaration, and the mixed recognition of Kosovo, and uncertainty among some neighbors in terms of potential volatility in the region. The one question that still needs resolution in the invitation process is the Greek-Macedonian dispute. Now, I don't want to go as far back as Alexander the Great, but believe me, they do. And it's a question of not only the country's name, but the use of that name. And this is where the dispute continues to this day. In fact, as we speak, there are negotiations going on. There's a new set of negotiations tomorrow, I believe, in New York. The long and the short of it is that Athens looks as though it's going to block Skopje's or Macedonia's entry into NATO, in other words, to block ratification. The parliament in Greece will not ratify Macedonia as a member of NATO, and it takes all NATO members to ratify for a new country to be accepted. A compromise solution, we have 1 week left. They've had 17 years. I doubt very much whether it would be done in a week unless there's enormous pressure from our side. But I think both countries, in a way, have staked too much on this. The Greek government, I think, is fearful that there'd be a vote of no confidence in Parliament if it does accept and the government will fall. Macedonian government, which is very weak, the coalition recently lost one of the main partners, which is one of the Albanian parties. So there's a fear in Macedonia that government could collapse if they make too big a compromise. The one possible solution is that there could be an invitation, but it may be conditional. In other words, it will be conditional on an agreement on the name and the use of the name before the anniversary summit in Berlin next year, which means that in a way Macedonia will be placed on hold. But hopefully the three countries, and I think this is the case, the three countries will not be tied together. In other words, even if Macedonia doesn't get a full invitation, an endorsed invitation from all NATO members, that this won't affect Albania and Croatia, that they'll go ahead and get invitations and ratification. So you can ask me more about this. That's the enlargement issue. The second issue is the map question. Again, I would say even more controversial because of one other factor, which is Russia. Just the background, both Ukraine and Georgia have asked for maps, which are membership action plans. These are not to be conflated with membership, which is what Moscow is doing at the moment to try and block the process. MAP is a program for achieving NATO standards over several years. Albania, for example, has had MAP since 1999. That's almost 8 years. Membership still hasn't been guaranteed during that process. However, MAPs do enhance connections, both military and political, with the alliance. They do contribute to military reform, modernization, and so forth, as has been the case in the Western Balkans. And the biggest obstacle to MAP accession, as I mentioned, is Russia, which doesn't fear NATO enlargement as a security threat and doesn't fear MAP expansion also as a security threat, but it fears it for one main reason, both processes. In other words, the reason being that it undercuts Moscow's strategy to bring its former satellites back within the Russian sphere of dominance. Hence, the Putin-Medvedev regime, I think, wants to restore Russia as a superpower or as a hegemon, regional hegemon. And one component of that strategy is to try and undermine US and NATO influence, which includes expansion, which includes MAP, which includes several other programs, as well as US presence, as we see with the missile defense question. I'm still not 100% sure that Putin will be there, but the reason Putin will be coming to the summit, one of the reasons, not only bowing out, which he probably isn't, but to exert some pressure particularly on the allies in Europe, that MAP is not a good idea. And unfortunately, the alliance is divided over the MAP question. Moscow has, in recent weeks, sought to drive wedges between NATO members, but by claiming that MAP for Ukraine and Georgia will damage Europe's relations with Russia diplomatically, politically, and economically in terms of business. And I think this is a form of strategic blackmail that disregards the security aspirations and national interests of both Kyiv and Tbilisi. And unfortunately, I would say some West European governments seem to be succumbing to Kremlin pressure, particularly in Berlin, indicating, I would say, yet again, that the West lacks a coherent and effective policy towards Russia. The United States' opposition on the MAP question, I think, is veering towards giving them MAPs. As you know, President Bush will be visiting Kyiv on the eve of the summit, and the question is he there to reassure them that they will get a MAP, or is he there to reassure them that they won't, but we're still with you? In other words, that sooner or later they will. And that's, you'd have to ask the president about that. Last but not least, very quickly, Kosovo. There is division within the alliance and recognition. There have been several waves of recognition. I think the number is now up to 33. I think one of the major signs that there's no reversal, which Serbia has pushed for, is that three neighbors of Kosovo recently recognized. That's Hungary, Croatia, and Bulgaria. And I think that indicates that the process is going to move forward. In other words, that there's no going back now. The big division, of course, is with Russia. Russia, I think, is using both Kosovo as a potential frozen conflict. They love frozen conflicts. If you look at Georgia and Moldova, it keeps them in the business. And also, I think Kosovo is simply one of the issues that Russia uses like a game of chess on the European chessboard. It's one of the pieces that it uses against Western influence, a sort of rollback policy, containment policy, I would say, by Russia vis-à-vis the West. Missile defense is one. There's also the Conventional Forces in Europe Treaty, OSCE, ballistic missile treaties. I mean, any number of issues, as well as bilateral disputes with individual European countries, figure on the agenda. And again, just to underscore again, I don't think there is a unified, coherent, effective Western policy towards Russia, Putin's Russia, and now Medvedev's Russia. I think I'll stop there. Thanks.
Great. And with that, we'll take your questions. If you could identify yourself and speak into the microphone, that would be very helpful. Terry.
What kind of stake does President Bush have in this summit? Is this important to him politically, from legacy? What does it matter to him?
Well, I would say that leading up to this summit, there was a little bit of friction between the Bush administration and the other members of the alliance. There was some question as to whether or not NATO needed to have a summit in 2008 in the first place, because it will be having its 60th anniversary summit next year. And so a lot of members of the alliance said, why don't we catch our breath, focus on Afghanistan, skip the summit in 08, and move to 09. And I think the Bush administration made the point that there were many things that needed to be addressed, particularly Afghanistan, but also enlargement. I think it's no secret that President Bush is a huge supporter of enlargement. Many people in and out of the government in Washington are, that Bush is looking to build a legacy. I don't think there's any question about that. This does fit into kind of his broader agenda of bringing these countries into Western institutions. And so we did move forward with the summit. I don't think there's any friction now about that. That has died down. I think instead of watching Bush at the summit, I don't expect any major fireworks between the Bush administration and other members of the alliance. Really, there'll be some push again to send more troops. But I think the more interesting two relationships to watch is the fact that Putin's there, as Janusz mentioned. It's fascinating to see what comes of that, what kind of rhetoric's going to be coming from Putin on a whole host of issues. And also the Sarkozy-Merkel relationship, which has not been going terribly well in recent months. There's a lot of friction between these two leaders. Normally, it's the Franco-German engine that drives not only the European Union, but a whole host of other issues inside Europe. And it's going to be interesting to see how those two react to each other and deal with each other, particularly as they've canceled their last couple of meetings to meet. And so I think for me, I'll be watching those two, both Putin and the Sarko-Merkel relationship, just to see if anything is said or something comes out of it, rather than Bush's personal relationship with others. I mean, I think a lot of these European countries have found a way to get past the dark shadows of 2003 and 04 when we had divides over Iraq and all the rest. And many of them are looking forward now to the next president in Washington and are already thinking about what the 2009 summit will bring.
Well, let me start by, you've conflated enlargement with MAP. MAP is not part of the enlargement process as such. I mean, you can have MAPs, as I said, in Albania. You've had MAPs for almost 10 years. It doesn't guarantee membership. In fact, the situation in Ukraine is very complex because most of the public does not support membership. So there won't be any security guarantees unless there's membership. This is simply a process to enable the military and the civil authorities to try and catch up with the reform process and with the standards that are met, that are pursued by NATO. So I don't think, you know, that's not part of the enlargement process. The enlargement process involves the three West Balkan countries. We already have commitments for several years in terms of a presence on the ground, in terms of their participation in our missions, their interoperability with our troops. Bringing these three countries in, I don't think, let's say, necessitates some major debate in the United States. I mean, there have been hearings up on the Hill. I think most senators are very much for enlargement. There's huge public support in those countries. It's not going to, let's put it this way, none of these three countries are under any major threat from outside, which isn't the case, I would say, for Ukraine and Georgia. Georgia, as you know, has two so-called frozen conflicts, which could explode into violence. Ukraine is still in a precarious position, and just in the past 24 hours, the Russians have raised the issue of potential division of Ukraine, potential claims to Crimea. Hence, membership is a long, long way off, I think, for both countries.
Andrew Gray from Reuters. If I could just follow up on that, specifically on Macedonia and the question as to whether, you know, the point has been made before that countries have to be security enhancers, security contributors to join NATO. Macedonia is a country that only a few years ago couldn't really handle an insurgency inside its own borders. As you said, its government is still quite unstable. Quite apart from the name issue, are you confident Macedonia is ready from a security standpoint to join?
Yeah, a couple of things. When I say the government is unstable, this current government is unstable. The system isn't unstable. In other words, other than the violence in 2001, which was, I think, quite well handled, and the Ohrid agreements were signed, and the Albanian community has been incorporated in state institutions, I wouldn't say it's a happy multi-ethnic society, but it functions. It does have democratic institutions. It does have economic development. Generally, it has good relations with most of its neighbors. And the Greek dispute really isn't over territory. It's a question of identity, heritage, name, symbolism, political symbolism, which is, you know, we may laugh, but I think it's important in U.S. politics as well. If you look at the Confederate flag, it does create, you know, certain passions in this country, and the name Macedonia creates certain passions between Greece and Macedonia. Macedonia, however, has contributed to the Afghani mission. In fact, more so than I think about seven or eight NATO countries with militaries, even those who are outside of Mitch, have contributed. In terms of its military capabilities, I think it's made a strenuous effort to participate in alliance activities. It's also helped the United States. It's given absolute overflight rights, basing facilities, fully cooperative with the U.S. military. So in terms of their security contribution, I think it's been very positive. In terms of the political situation, I think it's manageable. In terms of the relations with neighbors, I think once that Greek dispute is solved, and Greece itself wants Macedonia in the alliance. Greece does not oppose Macedonian membership. It simply wants that name issue resolved, and then I think it will for sure ratify Macedonian membership. So it's in the interests of all the neighbors to have Macedonia in rather than out.
Thank you. Tatiana Koprovich, Voice of America, if I can be allowed two questions. If we are not taking, for example, Russia into account, do these both countries, Georgia and Ukraine, meet the standards for joining MAP? Can we, for example, compare Ukraine today and Albania in 1999? That's the first question. And the second question, what kind of compromise do you envision on the MAP issue? Like several days ago, the talk began about talking about some certain action plan about bringing Ukraine and Georgia to MAP in Berlin. Like what do you know about that? Thank you.
Right. Certainly, I would say Ukraine, probably even several years ago, is at the same level as Albania in terms of civil-military reform. Ukraine has also participated in NATO missions, as well as American missions around the world. You know, it has troops in Kosovo, it had in Bosnia, in Croatia. It's participated quite consistently, I think, with NATO and other, let's say, allied missions. In terms of maps, of course, I think they are prepared because they've had these action plans already with NATO, which haven't involved the word membership. This is which has been the stumbling block. Membership action plans, I think, are just one step a little bit further than the kind of agreements they've had with NATO in the past. They've had training, joint training. They've had joint exercises. There's good sharing of all sorts of intelligence. Military officers come and train in the United States and study in the United States. I mean, they're very good, not only the United States. We have very good relations with the Ukrainian military. And often one finds in these countries where maybe the political system hasn't been yet completely stabilized, military-to-military cooperation has developed extremely well over the past decade. So I would say, yes, very clearly, I think Ukraine is definitely prepared for a map as well, if not better, than Albania was in 1999, which, remember, was only 2 years after the country nearly collapsed. Secondly, in terms of map compromise, I would be very careful about this, because if you start trying to put forward some new arrangement, I think it's going to confuse matters even more. It's either a map or not a map. If you come up with some new wordage, it's not going to fool anybody. It's really going to signal to Russia that we're not absolutely serious about involving these countries in cooperating with Western institutions, that they don't have a European future. I think it will send a negative signal to both Kiev and Tbilisi. And particularly in the case of Georgia, I think it will make them feel a lot more vulnerable to Russian pressure, which they're under sustained Russian pressure and have been for several years.
Yeah, no, I would just add that definitely Ukraine's progress in military form is highly regarded by the U.S. and most of the other NATO militaries. They have been a major contributor in many of the things that Janusz said, but also in terms of lift. Ukraine has been, in many ways, NATO's additional lift capacity, particularly for missions in Afghanistan. I mean, it's at cost to the other allies, but they have provided important support functions. So in terms of their overall contribution to Euro-Atlantic security, I think there's no question that Ukraine would fall in that category of being a net contributor. The real question, though, goes to the question of the depth of support and the potential polarization within Ukraine over the long-term implications of membership.
Yeah, David Sands, Washington Times. Are there any particular issues where the president's lame duck status is going to affect things? You say they're already looking to the next summit. Is President Obama going to be the same position as strong on, say, missile defense systems in Poland and the Czech Republic or Afghanistan mission?
Well, I think one of the concerns, certainly, and Julie didn't mention it, but is one of the other legacy issues is the missile defense question for the Bush administration. The hope that they had both, first of all, gotten rid of the treaty at the early stage of the administration, now the treaty limiting development of wide area ballistic missile defense, and then to now move forward and have this momentum both within NATO for theater tactical missile defense, but also to begin to plant the seeds for the development of this limited wide area defense. So I think the hope is that they can get an endorsement in the summit declaration, make it harder to walk back and move away from some of the commitments, even though I think many people were looking, even at when Prime Minister Tusk from Poland was just here with the president, what kind of commitments were being made to enhance Polish air defense as the way to keep their commitment there. The Czechs seem pretty firm on this, but again, the question will be how much of a priority will missile defense be for the next administration? And that's one that a number of the European participants, particularly the Poles and the Czechs, are looking at very closely and wondering how deeply should they become committed. But the hope is to, I think the administration is hoping to, by maintaining enough momentum, by putting in place some of these support programs, that they'll cement that as something that will be at least hard to walk away from completely. It may be slowed down. It may be stretched out. Even, as we mentioned, the administration has even told the Russians it's willing to stretch out the actual activation of those sites in Poland and the Czech Republic in response to a changing assessment of the threat from Iran or other countries. So,
I would just add as an aside, I mean, there do appear to be rising expectations on the other side of the Atlantic about the next U.S. president and the overall state of the transatlantic relationship, and that you know, if certain candidates were to win, there seems to be a great deal of enthusiasm, particularly for Obama, but also Hillary on the other side of the Atlantic, that there's going to be some revitalization of the transatlantic partnership and we start with a clean slate and a new chapter and all the rest. But truth be told, regardless of who wins, whether it's McCain, Hillary, or Obama, I think all of them feel absolutely the same when it comes to Afghanistan and asking Europeans to do more. So regardless of what happens in November, there will be a knock on the door on the other side of the Atlantic, I think, in early 2009, regardless of what additional commitments we get next week in Bucharest, to ask Europe to send not only more troops on the ground, but also more reconstruction and development assistance as well. So there may be, you know, I think there's a potential for a slight rude awakening, depending on the outcome of the election. But I do think that you could find very little difference among the candidates right now when it comes specifically to the question of NATO's mission in Afghanistan.
Thanks, Howard LaFranchi, Christian Science Monitor. Someone, I'm not sure who, but someone said that NATO's mission in Kosovo was clear, and I'm wondering if that includes preventing any partition of Serbian, the northern part. And then more broadly on this question of the lack of a common policy or strategy towards Russia, is that just something that you're feeling and talking about, or how is that sort of, how do you see that playing out? I mean, is that something that can just be swept under the rug, or is it just going to keep coming up in all these different areas? Is that something that's going to be approached by the alliance?
Sure. I think Steve mentioned that NATO's mission in Kosovo continue. It will continue, even though the mandate is supposed to change from UNMIC, from the United Nations mission, to ULEX, which is the European Union mission. But there is some confusion because the Serbs in the north of Kosovo will not accept ULEX, but they will accept UNMIC. If they accept UNMIC, they also accept NATO. So NATO forces, I think, are more active now in northern Kosovo. But on the other hand, they don't want to provoke things too much. They don't want to overreact to some of the provocations that some of the extremists in the north are staging, with support from some radical elements in the Serbian government in Belgrade. But I think there has to be a strong NATO presence. We saw the riots last week. I think NATO actually were quite restrained in terms of how they handled it. Some would argue they weren't sufficiently prepared for riot control. But this is something that they're going to have to, let's say, increase their presence, show they mean business, basically, but without provoking some all-out confrontation with the Serbs in the north. I don't think there's any possibility. This isn't Milosevic's days. There's no possibility, I don't think, that the Serbs in any capacity, whether military or paramilitary, are going to cross the border and provoke a confrontation with NATO forces. I mean, nobody's that foolish. It's more of a political diplomatic struggle than anything else. On the Russia question, just one more thing. Yes, NATO is committed to keeping Kosovo together. There's been a plan in the last few days that's been revealed from Belgrade to potentially partition Kosovo, and that is unacceptable not only to the government in Pristina, but to the Western alliance, including both NATO and the European Union. In terms of Russia policy, well, it's not just my feeling. If you look at the situation on the ground, there is no uniform EU policy. You could say there's no uniform EU policy towards anywhere, but particularly when it comes to Russia, it really matters for some of the EU members, particularly those that neighbor Russia, because they feel particularly under pressure from Russia, whether it's energy, whether it's their threats against missile defense. I think Poland gets a warning once every couple of weeks that it will be destroyed if it hosts missile defense. So, you know, it doesn't build sort of confidence, does it, vis-a-vis your neighbors if you're constantly getting threats and warnings from Russia. And I think Medvedev actually isn't going to be very much different than Putin. In fact, I think they'll probably work in tandem. Yeah, I think the confrontations will continue. I don't see any easy resolution. There is no common EU policy on energy. There's no common EU policy on what the plans for membership for the Black Sea countries, including Moldova, Ukraine, and Georgia. They have something called ENP, European Neighbourhood Policy, which does not, which is not a path to membership, and these countries do feel excluded. Numerous issues. I think OSCE is another one, democracy promotion. Russia's tried to block OSCE as an effective force in promoting democracies in former Soviet territories. Caucasus, Central Asia, and so forth. I think there will be points of confrontation. Of course, there will also be points of cooperation between the U.S. and Russia and between EU and Russia. The question is, how emboldened will Russia become in pushing those areas where it thinks it can gain advantage and push back Western influence from its borderlands?
Yeah, NATO's military missions are to allow continued freedom of movement, to protect minority populations, and to also protect religious sites, mostly Serbian monasteries that are in parts of various parts of Kosovo. So, as Jonas said, the key challenge will be to not overreact, to help the Kosovar authorities also not overreact to likely provocations, as we saw in the north and along some of the border checkpoints. NATO did respond, I think, fairly effectively to helping to restore the controls on those crossing points. We do have to still worry about volunteers coming in and stirring up trouble, but I think as long as NATO continues to work with the Kosovar to prevent any kind of overreaction that could lead to a cause, celeb in Serbia itself that might cause even further unrest, I think that will be the key to maintaining stability there.
If I could just add to that question on Ukraine, in fact, a Ukrainian soldier was killed during the riots last week, indicating what an important role Ukraine actually plays in helping NATO to stabilize regions within Europe, which I think really underscores that Ukraine's progress towards MAP is a good thing.
I'm not sure that was an initiative that the U.S. first broached in October, actually, when Secretaries Gates and Rice went forward to both offer a broader strategic dialogue with the Russians, but also restoring a dialogue that existed in previous administrations, but also to adapt some of these confidence-building measures, if you will, both in terms of the timing of the activation of the sites and the idea of Russian inspectors. There did seem to be some question as to whether or not there had been adequate prior consultation. I find it hard to believe that the administration would have offered that without some kind of previewing it, but I really don't know the answer. I don't know if any of my colleagues do.
If I could, I think there's been the distinction between military inspectors and civilian inspectors. I mean, both Czech Republic and Poland had Russian military inspectors for almost 50 years, so they're very hesitant to allow any kind of military presence, Russian military presence. However, they're not averse completely to having periodic, not permanent, but periodic civilian inspectors coming in together with American team. If indeed the Russians want to view that as a form of reassurance that missile defense isn't aimed against them. And I think both Warsaw and Prague are more than likely to agree to that. It's going to be a process of negotiation, exactly who they are and how long they stay, what they do, where they go, what they find out. But I think that's part of the negotiations.
My impression that it was going to be an additional commitment on the part of the French. I'm not exactly sure. I mean, the discussion has been mostly about certain elite paratroop units, and I don't. They have had special forces there before, but I'm not sure if it's the same. I haven't looked at this. Their actual unit designators or whatever. Who's coming in behind them. But my impression is that it's upwards of 1,000, maybe a little less, could be a little more, and then on caveats, I think that's probably going to be an enduring it isn't the kind of thing that would be dealt with at the level of heads of state and government. The defense minister has certainly wrestled with it in Vilnius. This discussion about the need to revisit the way in which risks and burdens are shared and how we engage in counterinsurgency operations as an alliance. I mean, I think all of that is out there in the background, but I can't see there being any specific decision made to, say, alter the, certainly, I mean, among the major concerns would be the Germans, some of the others, if they were to really take some of the restrictions off the way their troops are used. I don't see that happening at the summit.
Yeah, I would just add that this was definitely an issue that haunted the 2006 Riga summit as well, and they tried to show some progress on it by having a lot of the member states agree to moving their troops in cases of emergency. The problem is the term emergency was never really defined. We never got a feel for what conditions would need to be met in order to free up those troops and allow them to move on very short notice to the south if necessary. So there may be some sort of slight workaround again in Bucharest, but my guess is that this will be definitely a goal for 2009, particularly as there's still some indication that either the French or the Germans will host the 2009 summit. Either one would be looking to make some sort of major announcement if they were the host. So if Germany happened to be involved, it may be looking for a way to free itself up. But, I mean, there's a lot of rumblings going on in Berlin, but I don't see any major traction, particularly on the parliamentary side, that really controls this type of decision, despite what their defense advisors may suggest.
Wendell Goller with Fox. A couple of questions. What should we look for to determine which faction wins, if you want to use that term, on expanding NATO's role or rolling it back as the French may want to do? That's one question. And a second, Ukraine is already under pressure from Russia, which, as I understand it, wants control of the pipelines that carry natural gas to Europe. And several incidents suggest that they're trying to get back, Moscow's trying to get control of those pipelines. Wouldn't a map for Ukraine subject that country to more intimidation by Moscow?
I think what's happened in terms of the debate about where NATO's going in the next 10, 20 years, what its future roles and missions should look like, is we've seen incremental change over the last couple of years that would seem to indicate to me that we are ultimately moving towards the more bold, ambitious vision. The fact that NATO is now talking about the things that Steve mentioned, particularly special forces, it's getting into cyberterrorism, there are discussions about NATO's role vis-a-vis energy security, seems to me preview a future NATO that's willing to address non-traditional security challenges. But the moment when we know what's really going on with the alliance will be when the alliance decides to task itself with rewriting its strategic concept. The last strategic concept, you'll remember, was drafted in 1999. Of course, this is before September 11th. This is before the terrorist attacks in Madrid and London. This is before enlargement really was up and running. And so there are many forces inside the alliance, particularly led by Washington, arguing that NATO needs to task itself with rewriting its strategic concept, and that would force the alliance to have a strategic debate about where it's headed and write down on paper what its future roles and missions would look like, what capabilities would be required to undertake those missions, and what types of changes would need to be made structurally inside the alliance headquarters to get that momentum moving. But right now, what happens is a big, bold, ambitious proposal is put on the table, often by Washington. Then it's walked back ever so slightly, and then it creeps back onto the NATO agenda. I mean, we were talking about some of these same issues at the last summit or two, but now they're slowly making their way in a less ambitious form. So, for example, with cyber terrorism, I think there was a search for some big, bold statement on this, outlining what NATO's role should be. Now we're having the center set up, and we're just easing our way into some of these new missions. But I think the moment will come at the 60th anniversary when NATO will be required to put a marker down about what it believes its future really should look like.
Just to fill in a little bit on that, and this is maybe one story we might suggest that you look for, there is a little bit of a difference, I think, between the administration and some of the other NATO allies, and particularly the Secretary General, De Hoop Scheffer, has been calling for a new strategic concept for some time. It becomes complicated because of some of the questions of timing. You have, you have the next summit coming in the early stages of the next new U.S. administration. Not enough time to really prepare effectively for a full engagement with its new allies as a new administration. So, there's the whole question of can this really be done in that period of political transition in the United States, with the United States being such an important actor in the decisions that are taken. But there's also a question about whether or not the alliance wants to tie itself up in knots in the negotiation of a very detailed and comprehensive kind of assessment, the last one done in 1999. And having lived through it, I can tell you it was harvested at the Washington summit. It took a lot of political energy of heads of state and government, haggling over words. On the other hand, those words do matter, and particularly if you're going to say that we're going to reach an agreement as to what the roles and missions are of the alliance in this post-9/11 era. And that is one thing that the 1999 concept talks about: proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. It talks about the importance of new missions in peace operations. It didn't really anticipate some of the kinds of things, long-distance missions in counterinsurgency. It didn't really get into some of the questions of the role of terrorism, other humanitarian relief, global partners. Some of these other issues are still unresolved. And so there are some in the administration who would rather than see a long and difficult negotiation over or detailed strategic concept, maybe a shorter vision kind of document that could be harvested, either set in motion now in Bucharest and then harvested perhaps at the 2009 summit. But even that may be difficult, again, because of the American political calendar. But I think that is really out there. And just one quick word on the French, Wendell. I don't really think the French are about diminishing NATO. I think they want recognition of equal status, or at least a broader recognition that the European Union has a role to play in overall management of Euro-Atlantic security, and a recognition by the United States and other key allies that this role will continue to grow and it can support and bolster the overall effort, working more in partnership with NATO and less subordinate. I mean, overcoming some of the French concerns that somehow everything being led through NATO means European subordination to American leadership.
Yeah, the question of Ukraine, Russia, and MAP. I think Russian intimidation or pressure or potential corruption. Corruption of the Ukrainian elites, which is another form of pressure that they put on the country, I think it will continue regardless of MAP. But the Ukrainian government, which is fairly united on this, both president and prime minister and speaker of the house, which is for the first time actually in history they seem to be united on something, are very much for a MAP because it gives them a sort of sense of reassurance that they are moving closer to the West. And for them, ultimately, I do believe Western standards, Western democracies, Western security will be the best form of protection against a potentially hostile Russia. I don't think in that sense that MAP membership or non-membership is going to change Russian policy. In fact, you could argue the opposite. If Ukraine does not get a MAP, then the Russians will feel more emboldened that their pressure and their campaigning vis-a-vis the West has had dividends because Ukraine was excluded. So you could argue it the other way as well. The energy question, I'm not going to go into this, it's very complex. Russia, I think, a couple of things they want to do. As Europe wants to diversify its sources, Russia wants to diversify its provisioning. In other words, it doesn't want to be dependent on any one country for supplies it gives to another country. Hence, they're trying to bypass Ukraine, they're trying to bypass the Baltic states, they're trying to bypass Poland, which also gives them an extra leverage of pressure against those countries, because then they can cut those countries off without cutting off the West Europeans, which was part of the problem when they cut off Ukraine a couple of years ago, that it also affected both supplies and their image in Western Europe. So Russia's trying to diversify its routes, just as Europe hopefully is trying to diversify its sources.
Andrew Ward, Financial Times. Whenever Bush goes to Europe, he seems to want to always get as close to the Russian border as possible to make a speech or send a signal, and he's doing it again this time with Ukraine. How antagonistic was it towards Moscow to make that stop in Kiev? And what should we look for on that leg of the trip? Is it purely symbolic, or will there be serious negotiation about MAP while he's there?
Well, I don't know about antagonistic. Maybe you should go to Moscow as well before a summit. Putin's coming to NATO, to the summit, so why shouldn't Bush go to a country that is independent, has its own national interests? These countries should not be seen simply through the prism of Russia. I mean, they have their own security priorities, they have their own national interests, they have their own aspirations and so forth. Of course, you know, the Russians may want to use this as a symbol that somehow the Americans are trying to pull Ukraine out of the Russian orbit. But that's not the question. The question is, what does Ukraine want? And Ukrainians haven't fully 100% decided. They've decided on a map, but certainly haven't decided on membership. In terms of, what was the other question you asked about?
Well, I think it was alluded to before that it was suggested that maybe a deal will be done or an agreement yeah. will be made between the US and other NATO countries about whether or not there will be a map beforehand. Is it going to be a done deal before he gets to
right.
Kiev?
Right, this is what I questioned before, whether he's actually going, and I don't know the answer, whether he's going to Kiev to tell them that they're not getting a map, but they can get something just short of a map, with a promise of a map at maybe the Berlin summit, or whether he's going to reassure them that they will be getting a map. I tend to feel it's the former. I think there is sufficient German and French and other opposition to prevent, let's say, the kind of decision that was made to give maps to the West Balkan countries several years ago. My instincts tell me that there will be something short of a map or something qualified.
So the implication is that Bush arrives in Kiev to give them a decision rather than there being some sort of deal that the U.S. and the Ukraine can do to take to the summit?
I think it's both a decision, but it's also, you know, politics is also symbolism. It's a symbolism that your path is eventually with the West. But there's still a lot of questions that we need to resolve in the meantime.
I would just to say that that Putin's more confrontational policy, this isn't a dividend of Putin's more confrontational policy. That's one of the things the administration is going to be very wary of looking at somehow that Putin's bluster has led to NATO's hesitancy. So I think there'll be an effort to try to reassure the Ukrainians and also to show the Russians that that Washington at least is not wavering on the long-term notion that Ukraine has the right to choose to join or not join alliances guaranteed by various European charters.
One question here. I think there's general unity on enlargement. I don't think America's had to push its allies in Europe to convince them that Albania, Croatia, and Macedonia do belong in NATO. The one outstanding issue, as I said, as you mentioned, is the Macedonian question with Greece. I personally think that this should have been resolved, 17 years, well, at least 7 years ago, at least at the beginning of this decade. And here I don't think we put sufficient emphasis on a resolution. I don't think we understood how important it was to Athens. I don't think we understood, in a way, how important it was to resolve it in order to move Macedonia into NATO, because we thought eventually, well, the Greeks would recognize the fact that 120 countries have recognized Macedonia under its constitutional name. And I think the Greeks have left it late as well. The fault is on many sides. I think the Macedonians, in a way, for not seeing clearly enough that they need to compromise, for the Greeks for raising this very late instead of pushing for this several years ago, and for our mediating role, which has, I think, been fairly lukewarm for the past decade. In terms of maps, I think there is much more division here, and I don't think I don't think Washington has exerted a strong role. But on the other hand, we didn't know that Ukraine is also at fault. Ukraine was very late in issuing a letter, I think it was in February, that they finally issued a letter asking for a map. Now, that doesn't give you a lot of time for discussion, deliberation, and a coherent allied policy. So the fault lies on various sides. We can't push Ukraine to do something that they haven't decided to do.
Just one more. I wonder if you could talk briefly about the idea of France returning fully to the NATO military command structure. How much difference would that really make in practical terms? I mean, France is obviously heavily involved in NATO missions. The current KFOR commander is a French general. Can you put that in some sort of context for us?
Well, that's a very good point. It's true. Well, I mean, about a third of the French forces that are deployed outside the country are with NATO missions, and as you mentioned, a Command of Kosovo mission right now, about 1,500, I didn't mention that earlier, 1,500 forces already in Afghanistan as part of the ISAF mission, and another 2,200 troops in KFOR in Kosovo as part of that commitment, as well as the command. I mean, the main difference will be that France has opted out of the integrated military planning. Its military has always, throughout all of the last few administrations in Paris, has been very anxious, really since the Gulf War, as when they saw the way in which their failure to participate in the integrated military planning structure and to get some of the other benefits of the information sharing and technology sharing within the alliance was potentially really leaving the French way behind in the revolution in military affairs, as it was being called then. And really, all through that period, the French have been looking for a way, for an opening to get back to have a closer relationship. At the operational level, the U.S. and the French and the other NATO militaries work very well together. There's really very little problem. France adapts itself to most of the NATO standards and procedures for operations. That's not really an issue. But on the issue of integrated planning, it does leave the French a little bit outside of the tent, and in the sense of their overall understanding of the way in which NATO thinks about and develops operations is a little bit sort of looking, over the from the observer gallery. So they get a lot of information. They have a pretty big military. I mean, they have about 300 military officers assigned to NATO headquarters, but many at the military command as well. But it's, again, they're not inside the room when these decisions are being made. They're not as familiar with the NATO planning processes. So I think it would strengthen the overall and it will strengthen the overall effectiveness of NATO's integrated military planning. But it would also send an important signal, a political signal, in the sense that NATO is once again engaged in a full integration of its members in all of the activities and help provide additional support for the idea that the risks and the responsibilities ought to be shared in a more equal way. So I think it will still help enhance capabilities over the long term.
Just to add on to that, I think there's an interesting NATO dimension, but there's a very interesting dimension when you look strictly at Paris, and that is just the communications angle, because the French public, I think, has not been well aware of how much France has been contributing to the mission on the ground in Afghanistan. It's been a very quiet kind of behind-the-scenes contribution. You know, if you ask your average citizen in France, are you aware of the fact that your country has 1,200 troops on the ground in Afghanistan? I think you'd get, looks of curiosity. And so if France makes this big, bold announcement, both in Bucharest about increasing its troop commitments and then the full integration probably in 2009 at the 60th anniversary summit, and it hosts the summit, which is still being debated, that could be an interesting twist for the French public to kind of come to terms, because there isn't as much enthusiasm for the alliance inside France, much more stronger support for the European Union and its efforts to build a separate capacity. So that could be interesting to see how the French press reacts to that as well.
Well, I alluded a little bit to that in the sense that the expectation is the additional French forces are most of the speculation has been that they might go to – they're likely to go to the east where there's been – the mission has been moving ahead a little bit and to relieve – I mean, the U.S. will definitely be shifting some of those Marines to the south, and I'm not exactly sure where they'll come in directly in support of the Canadian forces in Kandahar, but I do think that they will – you will see some – you definitely will see an additional spike of upwards of 2,200 or so forces, U.S., into the southern region as a result of the addition of the Marines there. The specific question, I think the Canadians were as much looking from other European allies to step up to the plate and to support. And the Danes have been a little more quiet about that, but they're equally concerned about the sense that there's an uneven sharing of risks and responsibilities in the southern region, where the insurgency, and some of you may have seen some of the briefings our colleague Tony Cordesman has given on this, where the insurgency is likely to see an important spike in the springs. In the Canadian sector, I honestly don't know the answer to that question. I'm sorry. There will be some shift to the south. Whether they will be immediately in the Canadian positions that are occupied in Kandahar, I'm not sure.
Thank you all very much for coming. We will have a transcript out later today. You can find that at www.csis.org, and I'll also be emailing it out to you. Thanks so much.